And we're going to continue with Kevin Randall with your calls when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Kevin Randall with us. Kevin, photographs, when you were looking at the files, were there any there?
Oh, there's hundreds of them. Some of them, like the ones taken by George Stock in Paterson, New Jersey back in 1952, are clearly hoaxes. And I think the Air Force investigation on those specific photographs was quite good. There are others that are not explained, not easily explained. There was some taken in Flushing, Queens, New York, I think in 1968 by an advertising executive. Another case where they redacted the guy's name. but
named it with his name, right?
But we, at the bottom of one of the cases, one of the sheets, it's got his name. And, of course, I had a listing that Bob Cornett and I put together of the photographic files as well, so I could put the names back in that that case. And I've got a book coming out in the summer that's got the details of that case. But he took 9 photographs over New York City. And there's some interesting photographs of that. So there's lots of photographs in the files. Some of them are clearly hoaxes. Some of them are processing flaws on the film. Some of them are just teenage boys. I often say that the 99% of the photographs were taken by teenage boys, and 99% of those are faked. One of them that's not, of course, is the Lubbock Lights, and that was taken by 19-year-old Carl Hart Jr. Mm-hmm. And I found myself in Lubbock in the mid-1990s investigating, well, actually part of the Roswell case. And on a lark, I looked up Carl Hart in the phone book, and his name was there. So I called him, and it was the right guy. And so I got the story from Carl Hart. I'd seen the Project Blue Book file on that. The Project Blue Book file has written the whole thing off as birds, but Hart didn't photograph birds. And what he told me was he didn't know what he'd photographed. And normally when you get a teenage boy who's faked a photograph as a teenager, as he matures, he confesses that. But here's Hart, and he's in his 60s now, and he said he just still didn't know what he'd photographed. So there's some very good photographs in the files, but there's a lot of things that are clearly faked.
Does it bother you when you come across these hoaxed photos and hoaxed stories? Because that kind of puts a damper on good investigations, doesn't it?
Well, what it does is it allows everybody to just kind of ignore the UFO phenomenon because, oh, I heard that was a hoax. The Roswell case is a prime example. The Air Force said it was a weather balloon back in 1947. 1995, they decided, it wasn't a weather balloon. What it was a weather balloon. They just put a new name on it. But you take a look at the documentation, this Project Mogul culprit that they name in their report doesn't work. I was going to say didn't fly, but that would be a bad pun. But it doesn't work simply because the flight that they name was canceled, and it says so in the documentation. This flight was canceled, but people say, "Oh, that was explained as a weather balloon," and they can ignore it at that point. The hoaxes hurt because people remember the hoaxes; they don't remember the good cases. What does everybody remember about Bill Buckner? He let the ball go between his legs in a World Series game, and they ended up losing the series. You know, you make one bad mistake like that or one error like that, and everybody remembers it, but all the good stuff you've done, they don't remember.
Our friend Jackie Smith, who dropped the ball in the end zone during the Super Bowl.
Last night
will be remembered forever.
What an incredibly dumb call.
It really was.
But they'll remember that, and they won't remember how well the Seattle Seahawks played and how they got to the Super Bowl, or that they won last year by hammering my Denver Broncos into the ground.
They should have won this year, too.
Yes, they should have. But the hoax is hurt in that respect. But when you take a look at the Project Blue Book files, the other thing you have to remember about the Project Blue Book files, they say, 701 cases were unidentified. 4,000 are listed as insufficient data for a scientific analysis. The object is not identified, but the case is labeled. And that was became the mission of Project Blue Book, was to label cases. Didn't matter what it was, just label the thing and get it out of the unidentified categories. So when you take a look at all of this, I mean, I did a book 15 years ago called Project Blue Book Exposed, where we looked at some of these cases and, in fact, have a listing of all the unidentified cases at the end with the names in them so you can see who the people were. But you see, when you look at the files and you go through the cases, some of them are clearly inexplicable, and they put the dumbest explanations on it. We talked about Portage County. That's a prime example. Clearly, the guy didn't see a satellite because there was no satellite to see. And in one of the illustrations the guy made of what they were seeing, Venus is clearly on there along with the UFO, but they said, well, it was Venus. The Stokes sighting from the day, two or three days after Levelland in 1957, the guy's burned by the thing, and the Air Force is writing it off as a hoax because Stokes said he was an engineer. Stokes's employers, the Air Force, said he was an engineer, but he was really just a technician. Stokes never said he was an engineer, but all the people who knew him said he was operating as an engineer. They write it off. They said he didn't give them the proper number of cars pulled over on the highway. He said at one point there were six and another point there were seven. Well, gee whiz, that clearly proves that he's lying. So they looked for any little thing so that they could label the case other than unidentified and write it off. And I think what really hurts UFO investigations is the Condon Committee, because here was supposedly a scientific investigation of UFOs by a legitimate scientist.
Supposed to be impartial.
At a reputable university, and the guy concluded exactly what the Air Force told him to conclude before they even began the study, and the documentation exists to prove it.
I wonder how much money they made on that study.
Well, the total cost... The total grant turned out to be $550,000.
Wow. Back in those days, that was a lot of money.
Jeez. These days, it's a nice piece of cake.
It sure is.
But you know, that's the point. But so the Air Force paid basically $550,000 so they could stop investigating UFOs. And one of the letters actually says, if we don't get it stopped now, it's going to be 20 years before we can stop it. All they wanted to do was end the public
perception of it.
Yeah. Well, the public component of it, so they could continue on the investigation without having to worry about releasing information into the public. They also said at one point, and you see this throughout the files as well, that if a case is identified as a mundane object, then it's fully releasable. If you can't identify it, then the case is classified, and you can't say anything about it.
There you go. Let's go to Gary in Santa Maria, California, to get things started. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
I'm going to shove a lot of information in a short period of time.
Sure is.
Back in 1947, the head of the NSA, back then it was called FSA, Federal Security Agency, was a guy by the name of Oscar Ewing. He was also what was at that time the head of Health and Human Services. He came from Alcoa. He was Alcoa's top lobbyist, making $17 million a year in our dollars. And he took a huge... Truman appointed him. He found out, and now that's Mr. Fluoride. He was the one solely responsible for implementing fluoride in the water supply. Sooner or later, if aliens were recovered, sooner or later, the one that was alive would be offered a glass of water. He figured out that fluoride turned us all off psychically. The aliens communicate psychically, according to both Lynn Buchanan and the Majestic 12 documents from Linda Moulton Howe. And there's a faction of aliens that are highly psychic. They're afraid of us because they have no range on their psychic ability. They're strong short distance. We're strong huge distances. If fluoride does turn us off, and they have intentionally fluoridated, if you take a look at all of the major UFO sightings that's talked about in Majestic 12 and by Pat Price, every single country that had a base heavily fluoridates their water. I mean, almost to the tune of 100%, including us. If there is a huge subversive plan to dumb us all down psychically, cutting us off from each other and the aliens, because quartz connects us, and of course every communication apparatus in the world runs on quartz, we shouldn't be having race riots, as I spoke about the last time. If fluoridation from this guy Oscar Ewing happened to just keep us safe from communicating with the aliens, you're never going to uncover it.
Now, that's one area. I don't think you get into that portion, do you, Kevin?
I've been looking, in this case specifically, at what the Project Blue Book files have to offer and what we can determine from them. So these other areas, and what we find by going through this sort of thing is we find links to other things like that. And that's, you know, the kind of the link to Howard McCoy. Here's a guy who is deeply involved in UFO investigations, but nobody's ever heard of him because his role was ostensibly something else. And I think that's, you know, the same sort of thing. You've got to make the links from A to B to C to get there. And sometimes there's so much of this going on, you have to limit what you're researching, or you're never going to get anything learned.
Do you subscribe to the fact that we may have been visited since the beginning of time?
If you take a look at the Condon report, I think Carl Sagan said we could expect one alien visitation every 10,000 years. And so you take a look at that, and the answer is yeah. I mean, from the beginning of human history, we certainly could have been visited. And there's any number of solar systems out there, as we now know. We didn't, you know, 10 years ago, we didn't know this, but we now know, that are older than us, and that would suggest they would have an ability to have developed intelligent life much sooner than we did and could solve the problems of interstellar flight. You know, things that we talk about and we think, well, maybe we can do this, and you look at what we've been able to do in the last 100 years, for example. You know, think what we'll be able to do in the next 100 years.
Oh, my God,
could,
yeah.
Yeah, could interstellar flight be one of the mysteries we solve in that next 100 years? So, yeah, we could have been visited from the very beginning of time. I would think that any spacefaring race that happened on us 10,000 years ago, just as we're moving into civilization and we're building cities and we've got agriculture going on, that would be an area of interest to them. And if they visited during period when the Egyptians were building the pyramids or something like that, that would inspire you to come back to see how the evolution of the planet, the civilization is going. So it'd be something you'd want to keep tabs on.
Next up, we go to Joseph, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Joseph, you're up with us. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up a point about, I used to believe in aliens, you know, because of things that Carl Sagan said and the Drake's equation and things like that, that it's, you know, how many stars are out there and how many galaxies, or how many galaxies there are, how many stars in each galaxy, how many planets around there. You know, it comes out to be an obscenely large number that makes it seem that it would be definite the aliens would be out there. But then I read a paper, I think it was by a Harvard student, called the Simulation Hypothesis. And I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's about take those same equations, Moore's Law, which is the fact that computers, CPU chips, double in capacity and decrease halfway and twice as small approximately every year and a half. And you get a concept that's all those planets and all out there that could possibly harbor intelligent life, which is an obscenely large number, would, how many of those would likely, this is where it goes into the paper, how many of those would likely build a computer? How many of those that build computers would likely create a simulation of their own world or our world?
Yeah, he did that in 2003, but it was primarily for computers. And I don't think you can look at it that way for civilizations. I think the Drake equation, Kevin, is probably more applicable.
And what, with the Drake equation, when it was first postulated, we didn't have answers to some of the questions. We didn't know whether the solar system was unique. We didn't know a lot of the stuff, and now we can put numbers on that. We know the solar system isn't unique, that lots of stars have planets running around them. But the paper is also a theoretical construct, and what I'm looking at is the evidence of alien visitation. What we can find to prove that the aliens have been here. And so I'm working in a not a theoretical construct, but in an objective physical construct.
We've got Mark in Redding, California now. Welcome to the program, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi,
Kevin. Congratulations on the tremendous body of work that you've done over the years. And I was calling mostly to reference the business with the Black Vault having removed the Blue Book files because of copyright questions. And I had this kind of experience over a number of years myself with things happening on the Internet,
yeah.
People using my work and so forth. But it turns out that in Title 17 of the United States Code, which is the Copyright Act, Section 107, there are actually limitations on exclusive rights, so-called fair use, which goes on to say that if it's being used for a non-commercial nature, non-profit educational purposes, which it sounded like what it was being used as in the Black Vault, that there is no exclusive right, and so it should be able to go up there legally without violating or infringing on someone's copyright.
I think the problem is not necessarily copyright infringement, but terms of service. And that if you, and I don't know where John got his digital copy to put up there. If he data mined Fold 3, and I don't know that he did, but if he did that, then there's a term of service agreement which would trump copyright. But I don't know how John, I mean, I support John, and if you take a look at my blog, you'll see that I've got a lot of stuff from John up there. And I think, I agree with you that this should be available to us. Fold 3 has the Project Blue Book files online, and you can look at them for free. It doesn't cost you anything to do it. And I don't know, the thing that we don't know, or at least I don't know, is where John got the digital copy. Did he, the files are out there for anybody to get. I mean, like I said, I've got a complete set of the Project Blue Book files on microfilm, so I don't know how he got the files that he put up there. But Fold 3 made such a stink about it that he had no choice but to pull the stuff down.
Yeah, and I don't think he wanted to litigate.
No, I don't. Well, you want to, you know, you're a private individual. Do you want to go up against somebody like Ancestry.com who owns the Fold 3 thing? You know, they've got the lawyers and they've got the resources, and he doesn't have that sort of thing. So he had no choice to pull it down. And I think that's sad. I think that since it was information that was gathered by the United States government, it was released publicly in 1976. That you know, you have to argue that point. But I don't know whether I think the problem was terms of service as opposed to copyright infringement. But whatever it was, you know, poor John didn't have any choice but to pull it.
Yeah.
Down.
Well, he claims that, you know, he developed the database to be able to pick up all the files, but
I'm on John's side on this. So I think it's a sad situation. I think that the more of this information we can share, the better off we're going to be. And I think if people take a look at the Project Blue Book files, and I've tried to do that in various of my books, look at the files and the information that's inside them, and try to look at it as a neutral observer. And of course, my personal biases do enter into it, especially when I see some of the stupid things that are in there. But I think anybody who would look at it in an objective fashion would realize there's something else going on here, that the files demonstrate that there's something else going on.
Indeed. Kevin, we'll come back and take some final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, if you have the ability to get your internet onto your big flat screen television, you can watch beyond belief and it'll look great. If not, look at it on your computer, but it's free for 10 days. Just go to this website, beyondbelief.com. It is a rapidly growing television program that's internet-based. We stream it, beyondbelief.com. Welcome back to Coast, Kevin Randall with us. And, of course, you can track Kevin by going to our website right under his name and follow him on his website and his works. And, Kevin, what are you working on now? What's next for you?
I just finished a book that deals sort of an expansion on the government UFO files, you know, looking at other cases, newer cases from a more worldwide perspective and that sort of thing, and use some of the contacts I have around the world to explore some of the cases I think that are very important for us to take a look at.
Good for you. Let's wrap things up with final calls here. We go to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. It's Mark's turn. Mark, you are up with us.
Yes, good morning, Kevin and George. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
I want to make a quick comment. The guy, a couple of callers ago, mentioned fluoride. Did you know in World War One the Germans used fluoride bombs, killed hundreds of thousands of their enemy?
They sure did.
It's stuff very poisonous, highly toxic, and very effective. It kills quickly. Anyway, I called about, I was born and raised in El Paso, Texas, okay, right there at White Sands, and Holloman Air Force Base is 70 miles from us, and of course, there in the city, we got Fort Bliss Army Base, and Biggs Field, which is out at the International Airport at the south end, a small detachment there. But anyway, it kind of confounds me, having grown up there and everything. My dad was a private pilot for 36 years. We did a lot of flying around and out, you know, out of El Paso, and used to joy fly around there, New Mexico and, you know, down into Mexico and Texas, both directions. But anyway, I'm just confounded because I never saw anything really, except one night when we were out camping, and I told you about this one night. I called y'all about a star that shot across the horizon, then zigged back down, mm-hmm. ended up about below. You know, if I hadn't have seen that, and then I heard something in Houston once, it sounded unearthly one early morning. Otherwise, I wouldn't be convinced, you know. But these two particular events convinced me that there's something out there. But all those years growing up in El Paso and being around, you know, White Sands and everything, with these bases and everything, never saw anything. And I'm just amazed that I didn't clearly see some kind of objects up there hovering or, you know, flying across the horizon or something, or over the Franklin Mountains. Of course, I was on the west side.
Well, they do happen. Kevin, don't these UFO reports sometimes go in flaps?
Absolutely. They come in waves. People see a lot of things. 1957, we had a lot of stuff going on in the Southwest. The other thing that struck me as he was speaking there was the Air Force would reject anybody who was a repeater, somebody who'd seen the UFO more than one time. And as I was working on the last book, I was looking at the Kelly Johnson sighting that is in the Project Blue Book files, and discovered that Kelly Johnson, the skunk work guy, was a repeater. He'd seen flying saucers, seen UFOs on two separate occasions. So, of course, his reports are no good because he'd seen two. I haven't seen anything other than a light in the sky. Back when I lived in Denver, was growing up in Denver when I was a high school student. So, I think that the phenomenon is rare. So you don't have a lot of opportunities to see it, no matter where you happen to be located, unless you're looking at the right place at the right time. That you haven't seen something or you haven't seen enough, just I'm not sure that's a good criterion mm-hmm. to reject something.
Is there still some kind of, do you believe, private investigation going on, secret investigation into UFOs?
You mean government?
Government, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that we see hints of it periodically. I think that whatever followed moon dust is what they're doing now. But there's indications that they're still gathering this sort of data. You go to 1994, 1995, you know, the Air Force says we don't investigate UFOs, but they spent a lot of time investigating the Roswell case. So clearly, if there's something that comes up on their radar, they're going to be investigating it. Their investigation may not be oriented to finding out what it is, but sort of debunking what is in the public mindset at that time. But there's still stuff going on.
Off to New York now. It's Dan's turn on Coast to Coast. Dan, you've got us.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Yes, sir.
I always knew that the Guy Hotel memorandum was a real legitimate crashed UFO of alien spacecraft, but now I got the proof, at least as far as I'm concerned, because the fact that Silas Newton, which everybody likes to talk about, he had no knowledge of radar being responsible for bringing down a UFO. He might have heard that it came down in that area, but did not know of its power or to the ability to bring it down Only the Air Force at that time would have had that knowledge of powerful radar causing the mechanicisms of alien crafts malfunction resulting from crashed UFOs. Finally, there's also other confirmations of radar being responsible for bringing down UFO crafts. All people knew back then, generally, was that radar was only to sight an object. For the statement that radar brought them down meant that the Air Force was in possession of those crafts, and they made that analysis, not a civilian in which Silas Newton was, or Guy Bauer. And then the Air Force, of course, then released it to the informant of the FBI. And we also have to remember, too, one last thing, that the galaxy has a diversity of chemistry and physics. And if the physics and chemistry is extremely diverse throughout this one galaxy, of course, any spacecrafts coming here, their technical level or the biological of their being themselves will also be different. So that's why when we see them come here, they look strange. But it's not that they're strange, it's that their technology and their biology is different because of the physics and chemistry throughout the galaxy is different. And we don't have access to it here on Earth. So that's it.
I like that. Great comments. Good information there.
And as Arthur C. Clarke said, any technology sufficiently advanced would appear to be magic.
That's true.
And think if we took our capabilities back 100 years, they would think that we're engaging in magic with what we can do. I mean, we transmit pictures to our houses of all kinds of stuff, and we can, with Skype, we can talk to one another across great distances, and I don't know how many people I communicate with on a daily basis through the Internet. I mean,
Kevin, it seems to me that the really good cases we're not getting anymore. Is that a good perception or not? And by that I mean, we don't have the Barney and Betty Hill abduction cases anymore, the Travis Walton type stories. They just seem to have happened years ago. Why does that feel that way to me?
Carl Flock and I actually discussed this a number of years ago, that we don't get the same kind of robust cases we
right.
get. And we wondered if the problem wasn't that the aliens had been here, they gathered data, and they had gone home so that they could now analyze that data. So we just weren't seeming to get the same sorts of cases. And it may be that it might be somewhat like, you know, in 1969, 1971, 72, we went to the moon. We haven't really been back since then, other than artificial probes. So it may be something like that. We just don't really seem to understand it. But it is a phenomenon. We get a lot of cases, and there's a lot of sightings, but they just aren't the same kind of good sightings we used to get.
No.
I'm not just not what you're sure what the problem is.
Are they bypassing us?
Well, if we look at the 1973 cases, you know, there was an awful lot of occupant reports in 1973, the things on the ground, Pascagoula, for example, the Hickson Parker abduction case, you know, this vast body of really interesting cases that took place over about a 6 to 8 week period, and then all the sightings sort of ended. And, you know, what struck me was it's kind of like in the old days. You go to Africa, you gather your information, you leave, you come home to study what you found. And so we were wondering if that's not what happened. They gathered as much information as they could, they gathered as many samples as they could, and now they've gone home to analyze that data. And once they get it analyzed and they have new questions, they'll come back again to take another good look at us. I just, you know, really don't know why we don't seem to see the same kind of robust cases that we used to.
Tim is in St. Mary's, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Tim, thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks
morning.
For my call. Talking about the subject of these evolution of these craft, a couple weeks ago, Dave Schrader mentioned a guy on a ranch in Texas who saw something that was manta ray shaped, but clear and transparent. I live over here by a nuclear submarine base, and one night I was just looking at shooting stars, and I happened to catch the movement, and I have seen the exact same thing over here in Georgia. If I hadn't have been looking up and it crossed right in my field of vision, I would have never seen it. It does look like a one big giant wing. It's right at treetop level, and there is a very, very low hint of light, like where the skeletal system would be. And other than that, you like where the wing part or where metal would be, you can't see anything. It's completely transparent. I don't know if it's some kind of drone, if it's ours or if it's theirs. But if it is a drone, maybe we haven't reached invisibility yet, but we have definitely reached transparency.
Well, in these cases, Kevin, I don't hear a lot of cases like that, that are, you know, almost like that movie, The Abyss, where they had that look to it, you know, the ETs.
Yes. Yes. What he was describing is something similar that I'd come across.
You have.
A few weeks ago in looking for some of the modern cases and looking at some of the databases that have UFO sightings. So there has been some things where had they not been looking at it, they really wouldn't have seen it. In some cases, it seems that it's kind of blacks out the sky, so you can't really see through it. There's something there, but you can't really you see it because of it blocking the light from the stars and that sort of thing. So I've run into some of these cases recently like that. So there's some of that going. There's some of those people are seeing some of these kinds of things.
Isn't it possible too, though, that we're dealing with so many different ET races that they're all different?
I would suspect, if I was to speculate, and I will, that if there is some kind of intergalactic communication out there, that if one race found us, they may communicate with other races and say, you know, you might want to go and take a look at what's going on in the Earth and that sort of thing. So you get a variety of different craft, you get a variety of different kind of alien creatures. You know, if there's one, then you know, there certainly could be more than that one. And we don't understand the dynamics of interstellar flight. Maybe it's easier to cross the galaxy than it is to make a short stop. And, you know, the analogy is if I want to leave my house to get to L.A., I've got to go to Dayton, Ohio first, Cincinnati, to hit a hub so I can go back to L.A. The trip from New York to L.A. is much simpler than it is the short distance that I would be going. So maybe a short distance is more difficult to do than a long distance trip. I don't know. If I knew the answers, I'd be really, really rich.
Adam is in Elkin, North Carolina, first time caller. Go ahead, Adam. Thank you.
Hey, George. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
I just wanted to share an undocumented sighting with you from the early 90s, I guess.
Okay.
In my early teens, a couple friends and I were out in the yard at night next to a cornfield with a stand of trees across from us, and the three of us saw three lights up above the treetops in a kind of triangular formation, but sort of flattened, and we watched them there for a while. They were too bright and too close-seeming to be stars, and after a little bit, the two leftmost ones shot straight up really quickly and disappeared, and the one that was on the right hand side slowly went down on a diagonal into the deep woods to the south of us. And that is the only time I've ever had an experience like that. But to this day, if I don't lock my doors at night, I will have nightmares about an alien standing in the doorway of my bedroom.
I believe that. I saw a couple objects a few years ago, Kevin, with night vision goggles. These things were doing 90-degree stops and turns. Unbelievable. I have no idea what they were. They weren't insects. They weren't ours. They weren't satellites. I don't know what they were, but they were clearly up there. You could see that. You could just see them going, stop, and make a right-hand turn, and just stop there again and then go off. It was really strange.
And like I said, the only thing I've seen is something crossing the sky, and when it got directly overhead, it flashed once and kept going. It was in a polar orbit, but this was in the early 1960s, and so clearly it wasn't a satellite because there weren't any satellites doing that in that time frame. And we tried to figure out the trajectories of the satellites to see if that could be possibly what we'd seen. So I've seen, that's my big UFO sighting. It's certainly nothing as spectacular as is what the caller said. I mean, I'd like to see something like that, and with cell phone technology, I'd hope to get photographs too.
Kevin, where does this all go for us? I mean, what happens next in the field of ufology and everyone's efforts, people like you, what happens next?
I think what we're trying to do is separate the wheat from the chaff. We're trying to get down to the nitty-gritty and say, you know, there is something going on here. The Condon Committee explained one UFO sighting as being a natural phenomenon so rare that it had never been seen before or since. Well, to me, that suggests that here's something going on that should be scientifically studied.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same thing with the UFOs. We need to move it into the realm of scientific observation and carefully record what we're doing and carefully look at the documentation that has been assembled over the last 70 years. Look through it carefully. And that's the point of the Project Blue Book files. If you look through that stuff carefully, you find a great deal of evidence that something very unusual is going on, and it should be examined so we can find out if it's a natural phenomenon, if it's a psychological phenomenon. There may be some benefits to learning that. If it's alien visitation, there's certainly benefits from learning that. So we need to focus our research on gathering the proper information.
Kevin Randall, one of the greatest investigators out there. We'll be back in a moment as we talk about lucid dreaming with Robert Wagoner on Coast to Coast AM.